begin. We're about to begin. It's just about 4:30, and we're going to begin on time and end exactly on time at 5:30. I'm Rick Moody. I'm the moderator here today. I'm 74 years old. I'm retired, and I live here in Boulder. And I'm theoretically both a moderator and a panelist, but we'll come to that in a minute. The rules here. We've got a crowd here. We've got a lot of interesting questions, I'm sure, some wonderful panelists. And the rules are we're going to be passing around note cards. If you have questions, you can write them down. Yeah, Joe Howard's holding it up. Also, you have the app, perhaps, on your cell phone. You can type in your messages or questions, and they'll pop up here on my computer, and I will address them to the panel. That's basically the only rule there is. We're going to let each one of the panelists speak for 5 or 6 minutes each, going to give a presentation, introduce themselves to you, and then they'll have a dialogue among themselves, and at that point, I hope to see some questions and comments from the audience. I'll start it off simply this way. I've spent most of my career in the field of aging, gerontology, whatever you want to call it. I used to be the chairman of the board of Elder Hostel. Many of you know that group. Wonderful organization. Now I go on Elder Hostel trips. I'm no longer on the board. And I worked for AARP in Washington for many years. But here's the thing I want to tell you. When I turned 65, I went to the movie theater, and I said, wow, I can get my discount. And I reached into my wallet, and I said, I want, and the clerk said, no, no, you clearly qualify. That, by the way, is a true story, all right? Now, why didn't I feel good about that? Why didn't I say, wonderful, even though I've been an Elder Hostel AARP? So here's the question for our panelists, and you're going to hear some interesting answers to this question. What is positive aging? And why are you in this audience of all different age groups, I might say? And what does it mean to you? So as you think about your questions, be provocative. Be challenging. Maybe there is no such thing as positive aging. I don't care. I want to hear from you. So with that, let me turn it over to our panelists. I won't introduce them. They're in the program. You can see their background. And I'm going to begin with Dr. Whitehouse.
Hi, everybody. We're going to guarantee two things. One is at the end of the hour, you're going to be 1 hour older. The other is that you're going to feel at least 1 hour younger. So I am not positive that positive aging is a positive thing.
There you go.
There is a certain tendency among this country to put the word positive in front of something and think we've made progress in our thinking about aging. I'll come back to thinking about aging in a minute, particularly the intergenerational piece that Rick mentioned. The idea that we have positive psychology, we have positive psychiatry. There's a textbook on that. My friend wrote it. We have at our university the Masters of Positive Organizational Development. We increased our enrollment after we changed it from the Master of Organizational Development without the word positive. So I predict next year this will be the Council of Positive World Affairs.
It's coming.
There's a book, if you want to read a little bit more about this skepticism, called Brightsided, How Positive Thinking is Undermining America, by Barbara Ehrenreich. But I, like Rick, have been in the aging space, and I credit Rick with a lot of my positive aging. And I mean that more in the sense of a friend than in the sense of a professional, but we've been at many positive aging conferences together. Positive aging builds on successful aging, productive aging, optimal aging, enlightened aging, conscious aging, and any kind of aging you want to do. It is important to put a positive focus on things, but I ask myself, well, why do we have to put an adjective in front of aging? In fact, I wrote an article in a chapter in a book about intergenerational issues called Just Aging. It's a lovely double entendre, because I think the most important thing about aging is that we do it justly, and we just focus on aging. But my own work has been in intergenerational aging, in intergenerational learning. In fact, my wife, who's a developmental psychologist, and I'm a geriatric neurologist, developed 3 intergenerational public schools. So what I like about this conference is, as Rick said, there are people of a lot of different ages. So don't flock with people that look like they're your age. Take this as an opportunity to outreach to the undergraduates and do something intergenerationally, because I think it's enormously powerful in that space. The three intergenerational public schools in Cleveland celebrate lifelong learning and also celebrate what this conference celebrates, which is spirited citizens. If we can get the older people who vote and have, on average, more money, and the younger people who have the vision for the future together, we can transform this country and this world. But I think that's why I feel so positive about that kind of learning philosophy. I will say that Rick, my wife and I talked at one of Rick's conferences, and we were talking about the intergenerational schools. And right on stage, before I was about to launch the talk, I changed my title from Positive Aging and Intergenerational Learning to Purposeful Aging. I think the word purpose deserves a lot of emphasis in this space of positivity, because it's very important to living a long life or a short life that you find in life something that gives meaning. And if you can find that in relationship to other people, as a number of people have been saying at this conference, that's so important. I'm going to end, though, by changing into a different character. We have two of the world's leading, or at least bolder leading, actors who have encouraged me to take on their standing, and there's Henry, who encouraged me to, which I'd already agreed doing, to appear in front of you as Sylvanas. I'm only wearing my hat, not my other accoutrements, but I'm a geriatric neurologist who believes that human beings have an awful lot to learn about their relationship to nature. Sylvanas is the Roman god of forests and boundaries. He's intergenerational, he's transdisciplinary, and he is a kind of symbol for what we do in our schools about engaging elders and kids in nature to learn from trees about how to stay healthy. I honestly believe, as a card-carrying MD, PhD, that there is a lot we can learn by going out into nature and thinking deeply about it, what it means to be human in relationship to nature. So that's my message. I am a skeptic about just putting the word positivity in front of it, but you'll be hearing from other panelists about how we really do that in real life. And that's why you're going to feel younger at the end of this session.
That's great, Peter. Peter, I describe Peter as a one-man disruptive technology, and you'll hear more about that later. But this is called the World Affairs Conference, so we reach globally, and I want to hear next from someone from the UK who will bring another perspective.
Thank you. It's really nice to be back in Boulder. I'm 60 years old. Is that old, is the first question, really? So when is old is the question we might come back to. Getting older, getting better is the title, and so I thought it depends on how you define better. Because, let's be honest, we're not likely to be getting more healthy as we get older. We're not likely to be making more money or being more successful as we get older. We're not likely to be having more sex as we get older.
We'll get response from there.
However, I would argue that we are perhaps free of that desire to be successful, to make more money. And I looked up the third noble truth in Buddhist theory, which says the extinction of desire will bring an end to suffering. The extinction of desire. Fantastic. So, I'm looking forward to that. I recently did a project. I work at an art school in London, and I recently did a project called Generations, where we brought in a number of older people from the community between the age of 74 and 94, and they'd never been engaged with the arts before, and I got them to mix with a group of very hip, cool, trendy young art students at Central St. Martin's. And they did workshops together on improvisation, improvising theatre and performance, and none of them had ever done it before. And what we discovered in that is that we were really, those generations weren't different at all. We had similar hopes, we had similar fears, we had a similar sense of humour. And we also discovered that we felt that old age is actually the last unchallenged stereotype. because we feel that bias against, and I feel this quite strongly, bias against old people doesn't even bother to be unconscious bias.
Mm.
It's just blatant. So we made a list. There's a plethora of assumptions made about every person who is or looks old. And I'll read very quickly the ten, our top ten. This is the assumptions made about old people. One, they aren't very mobile. Two, personal hygiene isn't high on the list of priorities. Three, they like watching TV in the afternoon. Four, they like sleeping all day. Five, they like talking about the old days. Six, they adore young children. Seven, they get confused easily. They're not very clever. Eight, they don't understand the modern world like digital tech. Nine, they are right-wing conservative. Ten, these are assumptions. They would rather have a cup of tea than a glass of wine, and they'd rather have a cuddle than sex. These are the assumptions that we felt were made.
Have a drink on that one.
Have a drink on that one. I think it's true that, okay, this might be true of many old people, but it's not true of all old people, and yet that's how they're defined in the media, we felt, often. Positive ageing, a little bit about positive ageing. I kind of agree with Peter that the term is problematic, to use the term positive. And I feel that positive ageing is the same as positive living. So what's positive living? It's having a purpose, if you like. Mm-hmm. It's enjoying moments in life. And it's knowing and accepting who you are. Now, none of these things are dependent on having a young body and mind. None of them. So positive ageing is just positive living, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I work with young people who demand new experiences. And personally, I want to demand the same new experiences when I'm 75 years old, if I get that far. I don't want to be offered something that someone thinks old people like.
Okay.
I really don't want that. So, you know, I want to play computer games. I want to binge watch TV series and drink and eat chocolate. I want to talk about sex and not be thought of as a dirty old man, because I should be allowed to do that. We positively encourage young people to be individuals all the time. And yet, when older people are different, we label them as eccentric or weird. Why is that? Why is that? There is no reason. And the labels are problematic, I think, just as terms like Mrs. and disabled have become pejorative terms, so can, I think, senior, old folk, elder, and pensioner. These are problematic. So what is the right term, I wonder? Is it older children? Is it much older children? Is it older adults? Are they just people? Well, I mean, do we need any terms? Maybe we don't even need the terms, and the terms are a problem. I'll end with a quote from Maria, who is an 87-year-old woman who was in the Generations Project that I did at college. And she stood up one day in the middle, apropos of nothing. She just stood up and said, "Well, I want to say that the only 2 days that don't matter are yesterday and tomorrow." And she sat down. And this was a rather wonderful thing to think, we thought, because it made us realise that older people, along maybe with very young children, have the ability to live in the present. And that's got to be better.
And he ended on time, too. Very good. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Michael. New Orleans is not another country, but it's a remarkable place, and we have an ambassador from Louisiana here with us.
Yes, and I just happen to work in a very walkable, compact community, which I dearly love. I live with lots of aged people. I'm not alone. And unlike Rick, I still have to show my ID to get that discount on the movies and everywhere. I looked up positive living online when we started talking about this, and there were lots of definitions of it from all over. But my favorite was actually from the UK, because all it said was a way of living rather than a state of being. And you think about that. It's the way that you live that determines how happy you are, how happy you make the people around you, how many social connections you have, how physically responsible you are. And so I'm as an urban designer and an architect and planner, my background is for that, designing universal design to aid not just our elders, but women and children to access their communities. I have a personal story is that I cared for my father, primary caregiver, before he passed away. And physically, he was terrible, but he would just shock the nurses with his sharp, brilliant mind. My mother is just the opposite, and she's 96 right now, and I caregive for her full time. And she's just the opposite. She has severe dementia, but physically she can get around. And both of those people, both of them are having very rich lives, even with that diminished capacity. And that's why I think that way of living really makes a difference. It makes a difference. You need to keep those social relationships. Put yourself in physical environments. The United States, unfortunately, and this is my one negative thing to really
you
say,
can say whatever you
is
want.
That, and because I actually have a lot of negative stuff, was that we are not prepared for this by any stretch of the imagination. What is it, by 20, 30, something like 70% of our population will be over the age of 60.
It's a large number.
That's a huge number. But if you look at the way our country has been developed, it is suburban sprawl primarily with some nice, dense, compact, I'm not going to call them dense, compact areas of they're village-like or centers of cities where you can walk to everything. But those tend to be very expensive because they're in such high demand. So I think that it's incumbent because the baby boomers, we designed this nation. It's incumbent upon us to change what we did wrong, and we did a lot wrong. And there's a way that we talk about. I'm a new urbanist, so that's all I do is design and build infill development, new communities that are walkable and accessible. If you want to analyze your community, your neighborhood, your city, the things that you should look at are complete, compact, connected, complex, and convivial, the five C's. Complete, make sure it's mixed use, that you can have all the things around you that you need, from shopping to coffee shops, restaurants, the ability to reach a clinic, to have alternative housing types so that in your neighborhood you should have the right to move from a house to an apartment in your neighborhood. Compact. Within a five-minute walk, you should be able to access all of your basic needs. You should not have to own a car. You should be able to do this. Connected. Physical spaces in between. Look at your physical spaces in between where your buildings are. That's how you determine the quality of life of your community. If it is parking lots and streets that are dry too fast, that's terrible quality. You want places that have street trees that are shady, nice sidewalks, bike paths, protected bike paths. You want to be able to get around in that area. Complex, a great variety, because we're gregarious. We're gregarious people, and we love variety. Visually, we're that way. We hate to walk down a street and be bored. You want to have different building types, too, with you. A variety and diversity of all types of shopping and entertainment, play, a convivial place. You want it safe, welcoming, and most importantly, and I do put this at the top, beautiful. You want it to be aesthetically pleasing. If you can walk out your front door and you just, you know, just inspired, there's nothing that's more wonderful. You won't want to be in your home. But also, and I will bring this up, that architecturally we are very poor in this country, unlike the UK. I worked with the Prince's Foundation, and one of the things that we did was create different building types for all sorts of living that we brought back up from not only international different countries, but also from older historic areas. For instance, the Asian compound, where you have a small area where you have different houses that are they share outdoor space, but they're not necessarily connected. You have courtyard housing, which is all horizontal at ground level, so you can access it. You have mixed-use buildings with, small apartment types that look like mansions. You know, they're beautiful. We have a lot of those in New Orleans. But the worst place you want to end up is in a suburban tract house at the end of a cul-de-sac. It's isolated, it's lonely. You can't get anywhere without an automobile. And we all, actually, I had given away my cars. I gave it to NPR.
This is a fundraising appeal.
Thank you.
Okay, is that all?
No, well, you've opened up so many issues. I just have a slight change of plans here, and that is the computer always fails you when you most need it. So if you sent in messages on your app, forget about it. I'm not going to see it. But Joe Howard over here and on the other side, we have cards. So write out your question or your comment once again on a card. Ignore the app, whatever you sent in. And we are so rich this afternoon with perspectives from medicine, from architecture, from theater, many different perspectives of life. So while I'm waiting for questions and comments to come up here, I want to throw it open to the panel, and you have things that you want to say to one another. Please, Peter, begin.
So I'd like to just build where you were talking about community. London is my hometown. You should never tell from my accent. It was the first world capital to be designated by the World Health Organization as an AIDS-friendly community. My own work in the UK and in London is the US is around dementia-friendly communities. Many of us are thinking about how to make the communities friendlier for access to nature, and occasionally they talk about schools and children. It seems to be really strange that we're trying to develop all these friendly communities that are friendly for these different groups. And to go back to our theme, we really want livable communities for all ages, so they're universal design. So then we can kind of politically move and say we're doing communities for everybody, not just older people, not just kids. Maybe you could comment about your sense of what's happening in the UK and build on this notion of community.
Well, I hear about that.
I was thinking actually when Anne was talking that this thing about the place that is perfect for older people tends to be expensive. In England, it's the villages. It's the lovely little villages.
Boulder's that way too, let me tell you.
Yeah. Which isn't good, I think, because what it does is it kind of polarizes communities.
Yeah.
So we get a community of older people who are quite well off, I have to say, in a very beautiful village, but this isn't going to help the person who's stuck in a high rise in the middle of the city.
Right.
Cities aren't the best. I'm quite surprised that London... I mean, I'm delighted, but it surprises me.
Well, it's under your new mayor, not your old mayor.
Yes, that's right. Yes, not the old mayor. So I think there's a similar, to avoid at all costs, a kind of ghettoization, because surely a mixed community is the best community.
Yeah. Well, when Anne was describing these characteristics of this ideal community, I was thinking to myself, because I live on a house right on open space, and I say, well, this is great. But then the next move is to say, well, wait a minute. Who can afford to live here?
Yeah.
How do we create this? Particularly from a life course perspective, we've had one question here, and Peter may want to comment on this. Are there any longitudinal studies, that means over the whole course of life, on the effects of living in community with people who share this kind of ideal, whether it's successful or conscious or positive, whatever it is? And I note that in the front row here, we have some folks from Silver Sage right here in Boulder. Well, what do you think, Peter? Does this really work? Do we know it?
I'll give you two stories. One is Blue Zones.
Tell us what Blue Zones are.
Exactly. National Geographic, a writer whose name I'm going to block on, went around to find where people lived long and healthy and happy. And he found some one that gets a lot of press is in Okinawa. So he asked the question, what makes a community one in which people live long and happy? And it's not the access to health care. In fact, there was a slight negative correlation, so I don't know what that means as a doctor. But it was keeping active, keeping socially engaged, eating a healthy diet, things that are good for all of us. The other thing I want to just share is that there are now a half a dozen studies around the world in countries that are trying to focus on well-being and quality of life. It does relate to income a bit. I think it's right. It's very important we talk about this in a just way, where the rates of dementia, the rates of cognitive impairment, are going down. Relative to in general, as was pointed out, there are more older people, so we're going to have an increasing challenge with taking care of the challenges we all face as we age. But if you attend to public health, if you attend to the quality of community, you will lower the rates of dementia in your community.
Okay, that's great.
There's factual proof for that.
Yes, there's evidence for it. Peter Whitehouse didn't say it, but he's a world-renowned expert on this.
Yeah,
thank you. Peter is a renowned expert on Alzheimer's disease, which is not our primary focus. But let me, since I mentioned it, let me pose this to both Anne and to Peter. In situations where people are homebound, where they have dementia, where they're immobilized, can you have positive aging in that situation? Do we have to be healthy and mobile and active?
Question.
What's your personal goal?
Well, you know, most people, either their body goes first or their mind goes first.
Yeah.
And you can still have a very positive experience with music, with reading,
music,
with doing puzzles. Each is different,
mm-hmm.
But there are lots of artistic abilities that are there, and a conversation, and just having people around you, I think, is just the most important thing. I think we've got to maintain those social relationships, and I think they need to be with all ages.
Okay, that's what Peter believes, too. What do you say, Peter?
Yes, I mean, you can have quality of life in many different circumstances. A lot of quality of life is your expectations. There are people in the world who would, by our standards, be remarkably poor financially, who nevertheless are remarkably rich because they actually are living in cultures and communities where village life and family life is more valued. A warning about doctors. This is the tree doctor speaking, not the MD. Doctors always rate the quality of life of their patients with various conditions lower than the patients themselves do because... doctors tend to think that, you know, having all these conditions the doctors project onto people their own sense of what quality of life would be living in that circumstance. There are plenty of people who are quadriplegic, to your point about you know, being homebound and limited in what you can do, who would rate their quality of lives very highly. And look at, you know, someone like... the physicist, Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking.
You know, who's just made fundamental contributions and I think enjoyed quality of life and contributing, which is so important. That's the challenge if you're restricted. How do you still contribute to other people? How do you have those kids in your lives? And so on?
I want to come back to that. There was a question that somebody sent in, which I want to answer myself. It says, are you aware of the senior audit program here at the University of Colorado? I love it! Well, thank you, because I started the one at the City University of New York nearly 40 years ago when I was a bit younger at the time. And, of course, I've been involved with Elder Hostel, which renamed itself when I left the board as Rhodes Scholar, R-O-A-D, all right? Because people didn't like that name, Elder Hostel. They thought we used to get male hostel elders or
was that named after you, Rogue Scholar?
R-O-A-D. Or Elder Hospice. That was another one that we got. But this is a relatively cheap, free, low cost at the University of Colorado, and there are other opportunities like this, so people need to be aware of that, and I hope they are. Okay, I have another question here that somebody sent in, and that is, many older people... The senior audit program? You can take a course, any course you want, as long as there's space in the classroom. If in this room, you couldn't take this room because there's no spaces left. But if somebody wanted to walk into the World Trade Center, World Affairs Conference, you never pay, okay? And that's the deal at the University of Colorado. You don't have to pay to take those courses. Okay, they're not advertising it. $95. Small fee. Very small. It's not the tuition.
$95.
Okay, it's not totally free. Thank you for pressing that point. You do have to register. You do have to. But if there's space in the room, you can take that class. So you're not deterred by money. Okay. I want to get another question that somebody sent in. And this is also a money question, too, by the way. Many older people cannot afford to retire, but they need to work at least part-time. What about ageism in the workplace? But make it a positive. Can people contribute? Anybody wants to comment on this? This is a reality.
Well, you can work at home. I do.
You work at home.
I do. I work at home, and I actually seek out things that I can do in the community. And I'm one of these that wants to work. I want socially responsible work.
Okay.
And there's so much of it. And also, universities have great opportunities.
Okay, for volunteerism too. Anybody else want to contribute something, Michael, Peter?
Well, in the UK, I don't think we're very good at sort of at encouraging older people to work. I think we should, you know, we could do a lot more. It's kind of like, you know, you get to that point and in the UK and that's it. You know, you're not allowed to be there anymore. But I think that attitude is changing. I think that attitude is beginning to change as the population grows older. But it's not very
good okay.
at the moment.
We'll have a way to go. I have another question here somebody sent in. It says, and this may be for you, Dr. Righthouse, please discuss nutrition, sleep, and all of those things that affect our health and happiness and well-being in older age. What do you think? Anybody want to say anything about that? That was a question. Somebody sent it in.
The world is awash with brain health. There are brain health programs that are cropping up in many places. And that, I think, is a healthy shift away from, going and getting your disease diagnosed, but taking action on your own behalf to going into prevention, basically. The article that I will quote is one that I wrote about brain health, where yes, diet is important. Can I tell you the right recipe? Well, there's a lot of focus, for example, on Mediterranean diets, but largely it's going to be good for your health. I don't know how many cattlemen are in the audience. To get rid of beef, to eat low on the food chain. We're going to have to do that anyway, in my opinion, because of the changes in our environment. So eating fruits and vegetables and all those kinds of things. Sleep is really under-recognized as something that's important in this country and comes to the session on Saturday morning, if you can get up in time.
He's part of the session on sleep on Saturday morning, it's true.
But I'm going to say one last thing. I think that what's important to brain health is what I say the depth and breadth of brain health. The depth, I'm going to go back to what I said in my introductory comments, is purpose. I mean, why do you want to get up in the morning? What is it you want to accomplish for yourself? And ideally, the breadth is with whom. So I personally think that we don't want to hold people responsible for, you know, being a couch potato when the Broncos are playing or whatever. I mean, you know, none of us are going to be in charge of our lifestyle. We're all going to, you know, enjoy life by eating, drinking Coors beer. Boy, am I playing maybe the local audience here?
but
get extra credit. Thank you. But the idea that all those things are not that important. If you don't know why you're getting up in the morning and you don't know who you want to smile at first, that's bad brain health.
Okay, I got a question here. This is not necessarily a medical question. It might sound like it. Is our fear of aging because we are afraid of death? We haven't talked about that so far. And I'm going to use the D word and open it up to anybody on the panel. And if you want to speak personally, you can, or professionally. But let us hear from you. Yeah.
So I think this is a really key question. This is a death denying and defying culture. What's actually ironic is that the Alzheimer's Association has tried to create this image that dementia is worse than death. So you can almost put the other D word on the table as well, dementia. You don't want to grow old because you're afraid of Alzheimer's. It's a lot of longer conversation. I am not sure that people are actually afraid of death as much as they are afraid of dying. because it's the fact that they are not comfortable that we have a healthcare system that recognizes that death is a part of life, and that rather than locking people away and then pretending that we don't have dead people in our society, we're dying people in society, we need to be a bit more open and focus on the quality of life up until the moment that your neurons...
Is that why we're over-treating people, too, or over-diagnosing or whatever we're doing? Do you think so?
Well, yeah, I think we are. My parents are 93 and 96, they're both alive in the UK. And in the last 6 months, I've had a conversation with medics.
Doctors.
Where we've had to make a decision. The doctors have said your father or your mother might need this treatment, but if they have this treatment, it might impact on the quality of their life.
Uh-huh.
But if they don't have the treatment, they might die.
Right.
I had to make a decision with my mother or my father about whether to have that. And in both cases, we said no, we don't want the treatment because they're not frightened of dying at all. They're not frightened of dying at all.
And they were guilty about that.
Not at all. Not at all, because it's about the quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the quality of life. There's a very good book called, Atul Gawande, Being Mortal.
Okay. If you come away with only one book recommendation from this, I'm not going to recommend my book, although I've written several. Atul Gawande.
Yeah. Being Mortal.
Being Mortal.
Atul
Gawande.
And in that book he talks a lot about the fact he's a doctor. He's treated a lot of older people.
Harvard Medical School.
About when maybe getting better isn't getting better, and that's up for the person to decide. It's not for anybody else to decide.
Thank you, Michael.
And the tragedy of that book is a fair amount of it is about how he as a doctor dealing with his own father, I think was a doctor as well.
He was a physician, immigrant from India.
Gain the system to regain the system. He couldn't still work the system to his satisfaction.
Right, right. So even doctors are vulnerable. That's telling us something.
Yeah.
And I would like to recommend another book.
Please.
And it's one that all of my friends recommended to me. Mary Pfeiffer's book.
Just out recently this year.
Well, no, wait. This is Another Country.
Oh,
this is the one she wrote on aging, and it is an amazing book. It's Another Country, Navigating the Emotional Terrain of Our Elders, and it is a fabulous book. It goes through all different scenarios of family relationships.
Right.
Everything.
Another Country.
It's called Another Country, but you have to put in Negotiating the Emotional Terrain of Our Elders. Because there's several books
And if you look these things up on Amazon and you get Mary Pfeiffer, you'll find that just in the last month she's published a new one on older women.
At older women?
Yes.
It's called It's called Women Rowing North.
That's
and I
the
ordered
one.
It and just got it.
That's the one, Women Rowing North.
So I'm going to plug two books. One is I'm going to plug his book, The Five Stages of Soul, because he wouldn't plug his own book.
This is not an advertisement.
But since I've been nice to my friend, I'm also going to say, I'm not going to plug it, but the Myth of Alzheimer's is an interesting book.
That's Peter's book.
I do want to leave you with this thought. Alzheimer's is the elephant in the room of aging, more than death. It is not exactly what we think it is. It is many things that affects people differently. It's related to aging. And these drug companies that keep, losing all the stock because they're trying to find the golden ring of the cure are just on the wrong path. What we're talking about here, positive aging, is, to my mind, very important for reframing how we think of cognitive challenges as being.
I don't want to dwell on Alzheimer's death in our books, but I got a great question here, which is, it may seem a little off the charts, but the advent of self-driving vehicles, will this affect aging? But let's open it up to all kinds of technology. And to anybody on the panel, and talk about your tech. Look, our technology failed here today. But somehow we're still talking, all right? So is there a better way? Peter.
I used to be more enamored of this because clearly the answer is if you can have a car that you trust more than the Uber driver that picks you up, that will take you from point A to point B. That sounds
pretty good. Thing.
Here's the problem, though. It perpetuates our car culture. Here's a woman who gave her car to NPR. She doesn't need a self-driving.
Right. She doesn't need a self-driving
car. So we really do need to invest in bicycles, Uber in San Diego is renting more electric bicycles than cars, which is
setting drivers.
So, but whether it's a bicycle or whether it's a bus, let's not promote too many cars.
Okay, you're here in Boulder, and we got your message already. How about New Orleans and Louisiana?
Public transportation, and we have a very strong group of people putting in. We have four or five trolleys now, streetcars.
You brought them back.
And we're reinventing bike lanes, protected bike lanes. We added more than any place in the country, over 350 miles of it within the city. And we're also reconfiguring all of our buses and increasing headways. But we also have, you know, the bikes, the rental bikes that are everywhere.
Great, great. Other comments from the panel. I have a question here from somebody. Can cities reform their zoning regulations to help seniors avoid loss of travel independence and associated loneliness? Sounds like you're doing some of that in Louisiana.
I would say the most important thing for a government to do if they really want to protect and help all residents, but especially elders and children, is to get that zoning code and completely redo it, and do it in the context of get on your feet and walk around and look at your neighborhood. Do a form-based code that actually puts in place after a public engagement, mm-hmm. civic engagement process. Decide where you want intensity, and put in that public transportation. Allow more flexibility within single-family homes so that it's legal to bring one or two other people your age to have their own little units in your house. People don't realize this, but zoning codes across the country have the exact same language. If you think it's characteristic of your city, it's not. You can find the same thing here in Boulder that you can find in New Orleans. Well, in our old code, New Orleans, we just redid ours. But in my hometown of Monroe, Louisiana, I know I've seen it all. There's a company called MuniCode out of Florida that has something like 24,000 codes online, and half of them are the identical language.
So we need to think differently about this.
I mean, do what you want to do. You know, create a characteristic place that is convivial, complex, connected, complete, that you love, that bring your enthusiasm to your own neighborhoods and do it. Work on this 5-minute walk, which is a quarter of a mile walking radius. I mean, this is very. It's like 16 square blocks. So this is science. It's not just
pie
in the sky.
Something we need to hear. Peter.
And don't forget the trees.
Yes. Don't forget the trees.
And you know, trees communicate underground.
Yes, they do.
You know, they're connected.
The aspens, definitely. I'm glad to hear this focus on all the things that make Boulder great, because I moved here 10 years ago because I thought it was great. I've been coming here for 45 years. But here's a question. The Generations Project sounds awesome. That must be a young person who wrote that. Anything like that happening here in Boulder? And I'll answer that. Jack Williamson's probably not in the group, but Jack started several years ago here at the University of Colorado a program for 80 community elders and 80 undergraduates. The English department at CU sponsored it, and they meet together. They write life histories, life stories for each other, and in the process they learn writing, and they learn much, much more. Just one example, one of the kids, call them kids, they're 20 years old, whatever, in that program, who was an immigrant, said, "This is the first time I've really had a conversation with an American." Wow, what a story. But that's just the tip of an iceberg. So we've got to open this up. What is the saying? Think globally, act locally. But that's true for what Peter is talking about, the intergenerational school in Cleveland. It's a great model. We have our own model here in Boulder. Other comments or thoughts?
I'll just connect the dots a little bit on that. The intergenerational course that I'm working on and co-design with the community and with intergenerational partnerships is called Wising Up, Designing a Course for the Future. I think, as Rick said, a lot of this learning that we're doing should be, like our communities, tailored to what a community wants and needs.
Yeah.
But all of us, in my opinion, are going to be facing changes in the weather and the climate where we live. and that our responsibilities to future generations really need to be part of our conversation. And frankly, I use the word wising up intentionally because one of the words that can be positively associated with aging is wisdom, or at least seeking out learning that helps you reflect on your life experiences in ways that contribute to community and help design a future. Wisdom is not a given, it's an opportunity for older people. And my own personal belief is you have more life experiences to share with kids. I mean, and you have a little gray hair, they think you've got a head start of appearing wise. But it's really the opportunity you need to take to continue to learn, reflect on what you've learned in your life, and then offer to share it to younger generations.
Michael, I'm interested in the older actors and actresses and how they approach this. I'd love to hear more about that.
Well, how they approach it, they weren't actors or actresses. They were people who were just members of the community. They had never performed in their life before. So one of the reasons that we used improvisation rather than a play or getting them to do anything like that was because improvisation, everybody is a novice, everybody is into the unknown. So improvisation was the perfect thing for both the students to get up and not know what they're doing, along with the older people who were not knowing what they were doing, which was great. It put us on a level playing field.
That's fascinating.
I do think that the arts have got a tremendous potential for joining communities together. I really think it's an untapped. I mean, a lot of people think the arts are about the individual artist and, you know, the ego of the artist, but actually, as a kind of, as a therapeutic tool, in many ways, the arts are an untapped resource, I think.
Right.
We should be doing that more in the arts.
Arts as therapy also, enhancing living.
Absolutely.
Okay. Arts for public health. I love writing in the Tube in London because you can get a poetry lesson as you're... I don't know if they're still doing that.
Hopefully we can get it before moving to London, but that's great. Some other questions and thoughts here. Somebody sent in this question: what about access of nature and the constraints that human beings are putting on it? And they referenced the underpass for deer on the roads and things like that. And I love that because the deer come to my backyard on the other side of the fence in the open space. But is this just a trivial thing, or is nature more important here? I just wondered what you think about this, anybody.
It's incredibly important. In fact, there were so many studies done a while back that they actually determined that there should be at least some green space within 200 feet of every house, every dwelling unit, whether it be an apartment or a house.
Mm-hmm.
So within that quarter mile walking radius, there should be green space.
And in general, there are a lot of studies about health. A classic one that gets quoted many, many times was if people are recovering from gallbladder surgery in a hospital. That's back when you had gallbladder surgery in a hospital, not an outpatient clinic. The people that had a window that showed them nature recovered more quickly than the people that had a window that showed them a brick wall. That's just the tip of the iceberg, and I don't think the best tip. But there's really a lot about nature and healing.
And walking is incredibly important. Just 3 minutes of walking completely changes your attitude. And I think it's 40 minutes in nature, gets the creative juices flowing. I can't find it. I actually have a chart that has what happens after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. But if anybody's interested in that, just let me know and I'll send it to you.
I have a colleague who has a project called Walking as Art.
Walking as art.
And they walk, and it's an artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the engagement with the community.
It sounds like most of our panelists are saying that positive aging is a possibility for us if we shift our attitude, if we think about life in a different way. One of the questions that somebody sent in is this one: what are the three main attitudes or activities to keep us from being negative about aging? And I realize that's kind of a trick question because maybe there aren't three, maybe there's two, there's ten, whatever it is. But it seems like we need something to guide us in the right direction. And we've mentioned some books here. When I wake up tomorrow morning, how should I begin to think about this, that these three things, the attitudes that I should shift? Hope it's not too late for me at 74. Is there hope for us?
Well, trying something new, surely.
Okay.
Trying something new. You know, doing something new is very important, I think, whatever, right? And it could be a small thing, kind of. It doesn't have to be some major, you know.
Here in Boulder, I took a week-long program in mime 2 years ago from a student of Marcel Marceau, who was 80 years old.
Oh.
And I did it because I knew nothing at all about mime. I said, this is completely off the charts for me.
Yeah.
So I agree with you.
Yeah.
How about you, Anne?
I would say just do what you love.
Do what you love.
You know what your passions are. The older you get, the more passions you have.
Okay.
So do those. Include them in every day.
Okay. Dr. Whitehouse, he's my physician. I got to tell me what to do to be healthy and happy.
Gratitude.
What?
Gratitude.
Gratitude.
That's number one.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, look, I will tell you this. I have a PhD in philosophy, and I did my dissertation on Meister Eckhart, if you know who that is. And Meister Eckhart said, if the only prayer you ever say in your whole life is thank you, that's enough. I've never forgotten that. But I haven't always remembered to say thank you.
Mm.
So I don't want to say thank you to our panelists, but what I'd like to do is we have about 10 minutes left, 5-10 minutes. What I'd like to do is to ask the panelists, and I have a few more questions that I haven't gotten to, but I'd like them to kind of reflect on what we've said here this afternoon. And that's why I pushed it in terms of something very personal. What can I think about tomorrow morning when I wake up? And we've heard some things, do what you love. Gratitude, do something new that challenges you and you've never done before. I like all those things. And I hope members of the audience will take away from this something that's personal and practical, as well as perhaps guidance for our whole society. So let me just open it up and folks, give us your parting thoughts, if I may put it that way. Michael,
well, my parting,
our visitor from abroad.
My parting thought is that it's made me think that, especially listening to Peter and Anne, that actually in this country you're kind of way ahead of us.
We're way ahead of the UK.
I honestly think that. I honestly think there is a more kind of awareness of older people and as having an existence that is important as the contribution to the community. The things that they've talked about, they're not happening on the same scale, I don't think, in the UK. I'm not aware of that.
Okay, but you're doing the theatre work, so...
Well, we're trying to do it through the arts. And, I think in the arts is one of those ways that it is coming. And, you know, the Arts Council, for example, of the UK now have an allocated pot of money to support arts for older people, you know, across the board. And that's a really good thing, and that's a relatively new thing. But it's happening more in the arts, and it's not happening politically, I don't think. I don't think it's on the political horizon yet. That's because we're too obsessed with other things at the moment.
Well, you have some big debates going on. I won't even say the word Brexit.
Don't say it.
Pretend I didn't say it.
I'm not English. I'm European.
Yes. The politicians may catch on eventually. We always have to hope for that. We always need hope. Anne, I'm interested in your experience in Louisiana. I told you that I was there just after Hurricane Katrina. And a lot of the elders were swept aside and died, actually. But you used opportunities to reconstruct New Orleans and build on its past and its beauty, which I'm inspiring.
Well, the thing, you made the comment that it's never too old to change. I thought I heard that. Mm. And I think even just from being here and looking out at this audience, I think that is the most important thing.
Yeah.
Because it's not just individually that we can change, but when we get all together... You know, there's power in numbers.
There's power in numbers.
And we can change. We can change everything. Anything we want to change, we can change as long as we're willing to work for it.
Mm-hmm.
And in New Orleans, that's what I found. The neighborhood associations were very strong. The biggest thing that came out of Katrina was extremely strong neighborhood organizations and leaders that literally came from the ground up. But the thing that I noticed was they were not NIMBY or negative people. The strongest leaders in every neighborhood were those people who said, we can do it. Now let's figure out how we're going to do it. And they did it.
Well, Tocqueville 150 years ago said this was an American style, an American attitude, this bottom-up And we need hope. Certainly, we're living in a very polarized society. Some of you attended that session on America First and Trump and all these kind of debates. And at least they were civil debates. I was impressed by what I saw. But at the same time, it reminded us that we have a polarization, and we need to overcome that as our society grows old. Peter, what's your takeaway from what we've talked about here this afternoon?
So first, when we celebrated the 15th anniversary of our first school, we turned the entire school into a theater to put on plays based on the stories of the people that have been in the school for 15 years, and the auditorium became a dance studio.
I'm just
reinforcing before I give my own related answer. The importance of the arts in community and in individual lives. My experience with grandparenting has been really rather remarkable because I have 4 grandchildren under the age of 3. My daughters, she's not all one, 2 of them got started in a kind of one bump, bump, bump. And I asked my 3-year-old, who's not really going to school yet, but we call it school because it's an enriched environment, what did she like to do the most in school? And she said, imagination.
Those were her words.
Imagination. I was pretty impressed, but I'm not going to go there with you. I'll be proud of my granddaughter's vocabulary. I'm actually being proud of my granddaughter's imagination. So I just want my closing comment is I'm sitting here imagining you all looking a whole lot younger than an hour ago.
Peter's absolutely right. And I just want to add one other thing about one of our great heroes here in Boulder, Reb Zalman Schachter. Some of you knew Reb Zalman. I knew him before I even moved to Boulder. And he left behind a wonderful legacy in his book, From Aging to Staging. I hate to keep recommending books, but I'll recommend that too. And I was in a restaurant with Reb Zalman some years ago as he got interested in this aging question. And, of course, he was a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, and also an unorthodox rabbi in many ways. And he said to me, this aging business is really very simple. The only question is, are you saved? And I thought to myself, well, he's a clergyman. What does this mean? And he says, no, I don't mean it in a theological sense. I mean it in a computer sense. Are you saved? Are you saved? And he said, have you started doing your legacy work to the next generation? And I'm right now, these days, am working on my ethical will, which is a Jewish practice. I'm not Jewish. My sister's a Jewish convert, but I'm not Jewish. But I started that practice of trying to say, what do my adult children in their 30s, what do I have I really learned in my life that I can give to them? So that work is very important. And I think what Peter, both you and I learned from our friend Richard Leider, who literally wrote the book on purpose, the book about purpose, it's really very simple. What's your reason for getting up in the morning? What are you looking forward to? What can you contribute? And the Dalai Lama put it better than anybody I know when he said, be kind whenever possible. It is always possible. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you to our panel.
Thank you.